Hi, I'm Keith R. DeCandido, international best-selling and award-winning author of over 40 novels, as well as comic books, short stories, novellas, and more. I'm also an editor, currently hiring out through Creditorial, a musician, currently percussionist for the Boogie Nights, and a whole lot more. Hear me talk about my writing and my life, and also do readings for my work on my twice-monthly podcast, Dead Kitchen Radio, part of the Chronic Rift Network. For more information, go to chronicrift.com or to deadkitchenradio.mevio.com.
Hi, this is Simone Bailey from Battlestar Galactica, Stargate, Smallville, and Life Partners. You're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 26 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things you could find over on iTunes, you could find on your fancy podcast apps. You could head on over to Google, type in Dan and Travis, the show will come up, and you'll be glad it did. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts looking to put the culture in pop culture. Head on over to chronicrift.com for this and many other great podcasts. There's an old saying in the wrestling business, blood red turns dollar green. And that is the name of a trilogy written by today's guest, Paul O'Brien, from the beautiful country of Ireland, which it combines two of my favorite things, which is sort of the seedy 70s crime stories and the equally seedy backstage world of professional wrestling and promotion. These books have been out for a couple years now, but they have received just about as good as endorsements as you could ask for from people like Jim Ross, Bret the Hitman Hart, Mick Foley, as well as some of the top wrestling online journalists like The Wrestling Observer, OneWrestling.com. And they're absolutely just great page turners. I highly recommend them. Blood Red Turns Dollar Green. Welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express, Paul O'Brien.
Thank you very much, Sam.
So, Paul, what was the inspiration behind writing these novels? And I guess a more strange way to ask that question is, did you want to write these because of your love of wrestling, or did you want to write these because of your love of writing, or a little bit of both?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, to kind of set the table, I've been a wrestling fan now for 30 years, and I've been a writer for about 20 years professionally here in Ireland, mostly as a playwright. And I've always wanted to write that wrestling story, you know, that story that kind of took the average person backstage and just let them know that, you know, wrestling is a complicated and the further you go back, a seedy, dangerous business. And so I just thought it was a fascinating kind of world that was really untouched. And it was also kind of primed as well for the whole crime genre type novel. And I thought, my first thoughts when I decided that I was going to do this was I was kind of amazed that nobody had, you know, kind of traveled here before. Because when you think of the amount of wrestling fans and the amount of writers and even the amount of well-known wrestling fans, you know, I just thought, surely somebody is after kind of tweaking onto this. Then what happened was I heard a Jim Ross story, which is why I thanked Jim Ross personally in the third novel. He was talking about he was at an NWA convention, and it was around the territory days. And, you know, for your listeners who don't know, that the Americas were kind of broken up into different territories where each territory had a wrestling promoter or a boss that ran that territory, a cash business. You know, that nobody then could encroach on that territory. So it was kind of, you know, it was very kind of mafioso type setup. And it was run mostly by old guys who wanted it the kind of smoky backroom cash business way. And, you know, along comes this kind of flash, brash, younger promoter who wanted to put it all together. In real life, this happened. And so these old promoters were at the NWA convention and they said, you know, well, why don't we kill him? And Jim Ross heard this. And he was in the bathroom stall and he lifted up his 2 feet because, you know, he didn't want to become implicated in any sort of murder plot. Now, he says they since laughed it off and said it was a joke. But when I heard that sentence, I just thought, whoa, this is it. This is exactly what I need.
Well, here the thing about that story is, and like yourself, I'm watching wrestling and reading about it for 30 years. It may have been a joke. It may not have been a joke. Quite frankly, there's plenty of evidence to believe that it wasn't. And without giving too much away in the book, and because you know, I want people to read it and be surprised and enjoy it. But, you know, one of my favorite wrestling stories was Bill Dundee and Randy Savage facing off with guns in a parking lot in Memphis or Louisville, I believe it was, almost like the Cowboys in the Old West. And you touch upon some of that stuff as well.
Well, it is. I mean, it was quite a wild time. I mean, it was a wild time in general in that, you know, I mean, if you say something now, you get sued or, you know, you get arrested or whatever. You know, back the 50s, 60s, 70s, I mean, you could go into a town, you could get into a brawl, you could jump in a car and you could get away with it. So that all kind of led to it as well. It was that kind of that thing of the hit towns on a loop. They might come back to the same town, or indeed they did come back to the same town, but it wouldn't be until a few weeks later.
Right.
I mean, you know, you probably saw in Volume 1, these guys, you know, by certain wrestling promoters, or one in particular, they were encouraged to go into the local bars and start a fight. And if they won the fight, they got paid extra. And if they lost the fight, they got fired.
Absolutely.
Because they couldn't have, you know, a big-time wrestler getting beaten up by the local tough guy.
Now, you touch upon something really important there, and it's a big theme in your book. In fact, the opening chapter, if I could talk about that real quick, touches upon that, of the idea of breaking kayfabe, which was a very different world back then. Before, you know, everybody always knew wrestling was always done with a wink and a nod. Yeah. At the same time, for listeners who don't understand, what Paul's talking about is that the protection of the wrestling business was fierce. You wrestlers weren't walking around going, yeah, it's all just a show. Good guys could not travel with bad guys. Wrestlers had to get in real fights to prove it wasn't fake. That sort of thing is touching, and you really brought that home real quick and early, and I think in an interesting way that's will shock people who aren't familiar with the business, which is there's this big car wreck, blood and guts, and oh my God, this is a tragedy, and the wrestlers are concerned with, we can't be seen together.
That's it. I mean, you know, there's kind of a few famous incidences. You know, you think of the Ric Flair plane crash where a couple of people died. I mean, the one guy to walk away from that had to get into a ring as soon as possible, even though he had a reported ruptured spleen and many, many other injuries, to prove that he wasn't on the same flight as his opponent that night. Yeah, so there's kind of craziness going on. I mean, there's reported, 20-year marriages where, you know, the spouses of the wrestlers wouldn't know that, you know, the guy that they've been wrestling for the last 10 towns is actually, you know, a pal of his backstage. You know, they would grow up to hate, the kids would grow up to hate the bad guys who were beating up on their good guy fathers. And it was kind of a nomadic trade as well, in that, you know, wrestlers could be uprooted at any time by any of the promoters. So, a wrestler who's doing well might be poached by a promoter and they would come over to another territory. You know, sometimes that's across country or, you know, down to Florida or, you know, right up the top. Or, you know, a wrestler who's doing not so well might get freshened up and poached again, and they'd have to uproot the kids, the family, you know, new schools, new everything. And so you can understand it when, you know, wrestlers back then said, well, you know, it was real to me because, you imagine someone, we say, you know, a lot of your listeners might know somebody like The Rock. I mean, he was stuffed into a car several times with his wrestler father, driven across country, you know, down to Florida, you know, off to Hawaii, you know, left with very little money while his father was on the road. And you know, he tells that story way better than I do. But that's just, you know, a famous face to put these kind of stories and trials and tribulations to, you know.
And his mother went through that, too, because her father was Peter Maivia, the wrestler.
That's right, yeah.
So it takes a certain kind of person. Let's talk about that for a second, because something I thought you did that was kind of interesting with the character stuff. Because these books are not just about the wrestling business. Some of the thing that's interesting is the sort of alienation of the family. Looking at like the main character, Lenny Long, which is dealing, he's having a family. His family's growing during these stories.
Yeah.
But he's literally torn in the book of like, you know, I'm having the baby. Well, hold on, let me just tell the boss. Like, no, get in the fucking car, you know? And that's an interesting thing. I think some of these wrestlers actually are like, oh my God, I'm away from my family, and it's so hard. And then they become so accustomed to life on the road, some of them don't know how to go back to the family.
And, you know, this is the great tragedy that I hope the book, serves to cover. I think, you know, this is why it got so well endorsed by wrestlers themselves, that, you know, the book isn't just about, you know, page one, he kicks, he punches, he pins, he gets a pinfall, he's the champion. It's about, you know, if you notice, the novel starts off with a, you know, a huge event that, you know, Lenny Long, the new guy to the wrestling business, has to overcome. You know, there isn't an actual wrestling match. You know, I flirt with it and I bring you right up to it. I bring you backstage. I tell you everything about it. But there isn't an actual wrestling match fully laid out in the first novel, you know, because I didn't want it to be a wrestling book. I wanted it to be a crime novel that's set in the wrestling world. So in the same way we say, like, The Sopranos isn't about Tony Soprano's refuge company, or it isn't, you know, about, yeah, you know, the shop that he sits outside, the meat shop. This is the same thing. The wrestling just is the backdrop to see how, you know, and it has all the old tropes as well. I mean, it has, you know, this is what it's really about, is that the brass ring in wrestling is the world heavyweight title. And these old guy promoters who are all coming to the end of their careers will do anything to get that belt and control that belt, because that with that comes the money and comes the power.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens over the three novels is, you know, just how far are you willing to go as the promoter to get your hands on this title? And it turns out that quite a lot of them are willing to go quite far.
Paul, are you a science fiction fan?
I am. Well, I am a surface science fiction fan, in that I like Star Wars, but I don't know, like, what the second commanding officer's name is.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, I was going to say that what you just described, and it's interesting, I never actually put this together. Yeah. One of my favorite novels of all time is Dune.
Right.
And it's the world title, for sci-fi fans listening, the world title of wrestling is The Spice. Right. And whatever family controls the spice has the most money, most power, most influence over the galaxy. All the other families are going to be maneuvering, not necessarily attacking and assassinating, but maneuvering to either get the spice or be as close to it as possible. And it's interesting. It wasn't until you actually described it like that I was like, hey, wait a second. That's just like Dune.
but and that's it. It's quite a common theme as well. You know, like, I mean, I think this is great that this is a show for writers or people who are interested in writing. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to write a TV series,
mm-hmm,
and I wanted to put it in book form. And so when readers pick up these novels, they're treated to a novel that's more like a TV series than it is like a novel. And what I mean by that is that it's fast-paced, it's cut, yeah, like a TV series. But if you look at some of the, you know, the really good TV series at the moment, we say for House of Cards, it's The White House is the brass ring. Game of Thrones, obviously, yeah, it's The Throne, it's the brass,
exactly,
ring.
Exactly.
You know, even if you look at just outside of that, then you, like, have Lord of the Rings, which the literal ring is the ring.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this is the same. What I wanted to do was I set New York up as the pinnacle. In real life, that was the pinnacle of the wrestling territory. It still is, just because of it being New York and having the most famous arena in the world. And then it's surrounded by some, you know, really great wrestling cities as well, that it can do nice full loops and make a lot of money. I set that up as kind of, you know, like, this is the biggest kingdom, if you like. And then the throne is the heavyweight title. And then you have all these guys from across the Americas then kind of moving in on that and you know, bull rushing New York to try and win back that title. But they all have to do it under the cover of darkness,
mm-hmm,
because, they, you know, I wanted this to be real world. Nobody pulls out a gun and shoots 50 people and gets what they want and you know, there's no ramifications. Every shot fired, every punch thrown, every body that's led to waste means something, and it has ramifications for everybody in the story.
Well, like, not to give away a plot point, but like Merv's wife,
yeah,
is a MacGuffin that feels like nobody saw that one coming.
Yes.
You know, like, you know what I mean? And again, I don't want to give too much away about that, but that was one of like, oh, we did it. Oh, no. You know?
And the thing is, I don't want to give anything away as well, is that Sam character kind of lies dormant then for the second novel, and in the third novel, you'll see quite a different side. And what I've really tried to do over the trilogy is I've tried to write these like a wrestling angle, and you know, so almost like a slow release of information that make you see somebody completely differently from book to book to book. So somebody you thought for sure was the inverted commas good guys or bad guys. I like writing in shades of gray. You know, I don't believe anyone is truly evil. I don't believe anyone is truly you know, heroic, and especially when there's that much money on the line. So, you know, the way you see Merv's wife now, you might not necessarily see her when you finish the trilogy, you know?
Well, a good example of that is Dano, one of your main characters.
Yeah.
Who is literally between chapters. One chapter is the biggest prick in the business, and the other chapter is a very generous, gregarious guy. And yes. I think that is true about a fair amount of wrestling promoters.
And that's it. And you know, they had to be kind of the biggest showmen in the locker room, in that, you know, you would have a wrestler, let's say, who was, you know, from Samoa, let's say. We all know this. And he would have to play a Japanese wrestler when the curtain was open. So that was all the performance. That was all the, you know, that was the deal, the handshake, that was, and all that. I think the biggest performer in any wrestling company is the boss, is the promoter himself. Because a lot of times these guys, you know, aren't tough guys, or they're not, you know, legitimate businessmen, or they're not to be feared. And, you know, they have to, particularly back in the territory days, like they had to put on these kind of almost, you know, these Clint Eastwood-esque characters going around the locker room to make sure no one, you know, pissed them off, or nobody kind of, you know, stole the box office on them, or nobody left without, you know, paying up, or, you know, these types of things.
Bill Watts.
Bill Watts is a perfect example, you know, like... Yeah, you know, for your listeners who don't know, I mean, he has the moniker the Cowboy, Bill Watts. You know? Bill, so you'd have to come in and call your boss, hey, Cowboy.
Yeah, I think it was Savannah Jack, or I don't know who it was, but I know that there's always that story of Bill Watts, like, getting on all fours, being like, kick me in the stomach as hard as you can. Like,
he was one of those guys, you know, hit me as hard as you can. You know?
Oh, my God, crazy. And, you know, you talk about the performance aspect, there's always those famous stories. I know Austin Idol has one where... He won a battle royal, and the promoter accidentally, like, in order to prove it was a real battle royal and a real prize, the promoter gave him, like, a real $5,000 check. And Austin Idol took it to the bank and cashed it.
That's it.
It was like, oh, I got it now. Sorry, pal. And there was, what's that old famous, I know that there's, like, many promoters have done this trick. I don't know if, I don't want to get anybody's names wrong with that, but there was always the, You'd promote to a big show, like a WrestleMania, but it wouldn't be on pay-per-view or anything. It would just be one of those big house shows. You know, we rented out the big arena in town. Andre the Giant's coming in or whatever, and it's going to be a big old show, and the wrestlers are excited, and then they have this great show, great house, lots of money goes around, they go to get paid, and the promoter walks out. It's like, would you believe it? We got held up. Somebody robbed the box office.
That's right, yeah. And again, you know, there's trinkles of that in these novels as well. The things they used to do to not pay people was just phenomenal, you know. And then, of course, it moves on to, like, crazy stuff. Like, you know, there's a story in the second novel where a young kid down in Texas has to wrestle a bear, you know. And the outsider in the novel is asking the question, well, you know, well, how do we mimic a bear? Like, how do we fool the audience? You know, and the character in the book says, we get a bear. you know, so there's all those famous stories of people wrestling bears, and then the old timers putting, like, honey on their hands and slapping the kid on the back and patting him on the ass as he's going outside, so the bear, like, get way more curious. You know, it's just crazy.
It was. When I was reading the first novel, I was like, this reminds me of something. And it wasn't pardon the dog in the back. She gets excited about wrestling. hey. And it took me to realize, I was like, this reminds me a lot like the Friends of Eddie Coyle.
Right.
If you've ever seen that movie. Or like a Mean Streets. Oh, it's great. Yeah. Oh, you'll love it. Trust me.
Right.
Because it totally reminds me of your book.
Really? Brilliant.
And in a good way, because it is like that seedy underbelly. And the thing that's interesting about this world, it's a seedy underbelly. You know, we're talking about crazy things promoters and people are doing. Yeah. But at the same time, there's a sense of ethics.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if Jim Cornette ever hears this interview, he's probably going to be clenching his fist going, but they weren't all crooks.
Yeah,
and exactly. He's right. They weren't all crooks. There were people who did actually, a handshake meant something. You know, Don Owens was a promoter who was known to be an honest payoff guy who guys wanted to work for and things like that.
So, and Vince Senior, you know, was supposed to be the best handshake guy in the business as well, you know.
Absolutely.
People might know Vince McMahon now, the current owner of WWE, but his father was a wrestling boxing promoter. His grandfather was a boxing promoter, and both those guys actually had a good golden handshake coming out of New York. So you're right. I mean, it's like most, you know, a machine like that. So, you know, if we look at it kind of starting from the 1900s, starting off in the carnivals, you know, where it's literal dollars and cents they're fighting over, to a $1 billion industry, had to have a pretty great machine behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to have, you know, like, many broken backs working down in the mine to make sure that the diamond got out. And I think that's, for me, that's what wrestling is. If I think of all the thousands of wrestlers who came and you know, all the millions of fans who've sat in the arenas and all the times that the secret was kept and handed on and not spoken about, and, you know, all the new guys brought in and they were all kept, you know, to kayfabe the secret as well. Until it got up to the point, like you said, it was always a nod and a wink. I mean, I've seen reports in the 40s where, you know, journalists were just outright saying, this is predetermined, this is fake, this is set up, this isn't a match. And still, wrestlers survived all of that.
Yeah.
Up till now, where, you know, it's quite a shiny, kids-friendly TV show that's you know, pulling in millions of fans still.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, I heard you hesitate about the word fake.
Yeah.
And me too, man. Because it's not. It's not fake. It just isn't. That's not the right word. And it's like, wrestling is wrestling. It's not. It's a show and everything. I don't know if you've seen Lucha Underground yet.
Yeah, Lucha's is it's amazing.
Yeah, but like what they're doing on this new show on El Rey is they're putting incidental music on the scenes. You know, they're combining the wrestling and the TV show elements to the point of like, look, everybody knows what this is.
Yep.
So let's not pretend, and people are eating it up. It's poised to explode.
It's a great show, and you're right. The word, like, I had a conversation with a couple of wrestlers who, you know, like I said, with these novels, I've been lucky enough to have phone calls to, you know, to be able to sit down with or email, and quite a lot of big names at this stage, and I hold that most dear. And even there's a tagline for this, these novels called, you know, these guys protect America's longest con. And I was really wary. I thought I'd let the wrestlers down by calling it a con. So I got onto a couple of wrestlers who, you know, would be really well respected in the business and said, listen, if I use this, would you guys or anybody be offended, you know? And it actually took one of my dad to get back to me because, it means so much to them to uphold, you know, the respect in the business. And they said, look, we know where you're coming from. You don't mean, you know, any harm to us, or you're not trying to disrespect us. We've read these novels. We know that you're coming at this from a compassionate, empathetic, realistic angle. So, you know, go ahead with it. And, you know, that's what I want. I see it as a... You know, these guys didn't have to let me into their world. The first novel I wrote, I had to do just based on research. I had no kind of, you know, person I could phone or call. The second novel, I had a couple of people. The third novel, I had a range of people who I was able to pick up the phone to or email and say, listen, you know, what color was this wall? What size was this room? You know, was there parking outside this building? Because I wanted to get it that meticulously right. And they dived in and helped me out.
And what's so funny about that is like, is that's the world so many fans want to see. You know what I mean? Like the locker rooms are as unglamorous as can be, folks. I've been in a couple. But you're in the locker room, and there's something. That's where they're figuring out their matches. That's where they're figuring this out, that out, and like walking up. And it's funny, Larry Zbyszko told a story about how when he drove to the Pittsburgh arena to see his match versus Bruno Sammartino.
Right.
And well, he got there early or whatever to go over the match, and he saw Zbyszko above the arena. And it's empty. There's nobody around. It's just an empty parking lot, freezing Pittsburgh. And he just sat in his car and was like, wow, look at that. You know? And there's a magic to some of that stuff.
Absolutely.
How did this book get in the hands? Because, all right, so you write a novel about wrestling, and that's great. But how did this book get in the hands of people like Jim Ross and Mick Foley and Bret Hart? Was it you spreading it out to them, or did they come across it themselves?
There was some light stalking going on, some light Twitter stalking.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Foley was first in that. I figured, as you know, the hardest fans to convince that wrestling can be anything else other than the product they see is wrestling fans. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just, wrestling books are autobiographies, that's it. You know, so I knew that I just needed somebody to... You know, somebody who would command respect and somebody who would endorse the novels to kind of give me a little foot up on the... So it took about a year, about three or four tweets to Mick Foley. I promised him that this isn't some awful fan fiction. And I had to walk the line of, you know, kind of giving him my CV because, you know, he probably would have said, well, you know, I still don't know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I was trying to make to him was that I've been writing professionally for 20 years and... you know, this isn't going to turn into some erotic fiction based on WWE characters, you know. And he read it before WrestleMania 28, I believe. He brought it with him on the flight. And because of the time difference, I'm here in Ireland, I got a little notification beep on my phone about 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was Mick Foley, and he said, I read this book. I absolutely loved it. I had no idea that it was going to be this. And I'd love to endorse it any way I can, and I want to help you any way I can. And I was just blown away, you know. And this was before iPhone Mick Foley, when he had his little Verizon. So he sent me a video, you know, this pixelated, hey, everybody, this is WW Mick Foley here, and I believe you should read this novel. And I must have looked at that video 50 times, you know, with a big grin on my face. Just thinking, you know, how cool is this guy that he's getting absolutely nothing from it. He doesn't have to do it. He just wants his fans to know that he enjoyed this novel about wrestling. So Mick Foley was first, and then came, once you kind of, you know yourself, once one wrestler pats you on the back and says, this guy is okay, then it's kind of, it's a little bit easier then to get the next wrestler. He's not as wary, especially when somebody like Mick Foley kind of endorses you. William Regal came next. He was really important to me because William Regal doesn't endorse anything. He doesn't talk about anything. He doesn't come out and give his opinion on anything to do with the wrestling business unless it's his company's DVDs, the WWE DVDs. But hugely respected, as you know. So he come out. He said he was in awe of these novels. And I knew as well he wouldn't pull any punches in terms of the research and was did this world feel right. You know, so when he said he was in awe of the research and he loved these novels, and then came JR and Bret the Hitman Hart and Finn Balor and, you know, Sheamus. And speaking of Jim Cornette, I sent it to Jim Cornette as well. And he said, I'm not reading that. I lived through it. So thanks to Jim Cornette.
It could be, but hey, Jim, if you're listening, give it another try. Well, you know, at your own time. I'm not trying to tell him what to do. I don't want a tennis racket across the back. So you did touch upon something that's kind of important, though, in the world of screenwriting and networking, and I think that's a good tip, which is, and you said you've been writing plays and things in Ireland, and I'm assuming you've probably written a couple non-wrestling books. My apologies for not being so familiar with those.
No, actually, the first book that you have is the first novel I've ever written. So,
but the point is, like you said, you have a CV, you have a resume, you're able to say to somebody like a Mick Foley when reaching out, because it's very hard for us aspiring screenwriters sometimes to reach out to somebody and say, hey, you should read my script, you should read my story, because a lot of times people will say, well, why should I? And that's why it's important for us aspiring screenwriters to, one, either place in some festivals, get some festival accolades, also produce your own stuff. Produce, you know, if you can make some shorts, if you have some great scenes in your script, and I'm like, man, let me get some people together and we could act it out and put it on YouTube and things like that. People are going to be a lot more willing to listen to you as opposed to just read my script because I'm brilliant. Absolutely. Nobody's going to do that. You need a little bit of credibility and stuff. So that's a really great point that you brought up there.
It is. It's like, you know, I can only imagine how many people ask Mick Foley for a favor, number one, because he is who he is, and he's known to be generous, and then also because he's such a great writer himself, you know, how many people ask him to read something. So, like, he was the double whammy for me. He was a respected wrestler who was also a New York Times bestseller, who was a legitimate, fantastic writer himself. I think the thing that might have got him from, I have these little weird kind of quirks on my CV. Like, so for instance, my first play here in Ireland was paid for by Martin McDonagh, you know, the Oscar winner for In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths and everything. And when people hear stuff like that, all they hear is Oscar.
Yeah.
And so you, for me, I mean, I echo what you said. I go through my CV and I find out, okay, what's the kind of buzz terms that people are going to... Because I've done the 10-page CV. I've done that. I've made that mistake. Nobody reads the 10-page CV. You know, for me, I just wanted to get down to, okay, what's relevant here? You know, so who has already, you know, kind of endorsed me or patted me on the back or helped me out? Or, and there's no greater endorsement than someone putting their hand in their pocket and writing a check for 20 grand and saying, I believe in this young playwright. My name is Martin McDonagh. Here's my money. I'm literally putting my money where my mouth is. Put that on your CV. So stuff like that really helps as well, you know?
No, outstanding. And I think, and wear it. I mean, hell, wear it. Like, sometimes we get very shy and humble and like, oh, well, you know, blah, blah. Like, I won, and I don't mean this in a braggadocious way. I won 2 screenplay contests last year.
Yeah.
It took me a while to put award-winning screenwriter on my Twitter.
Really? Because
I'm like, I was like, wait, I am technically yes. an award-winning screenwriter. Because, you know, you're doing your work and you're doing your things. You don't want to come off as like some kind of cocky asshole, you know. You want to be like, hey, no, I'm still unsigned, I'm still aspiring, I still have a lot of things I'm trying to do in the business, so it's not like the battle is done.
Exactly.
And I think there's something about I got a lot of thoughts based on stuff you're saying. Like, Mick Foley is a good example. And we talk about this crazy world of wrestling, and you're writing, or just crazy world, you're writing about a crazy, seedy underbelly of a place. And what comes across, why is Mick Foley endorsing your book? Why is it William Regal endorsing your book? Why are they taking the time to read it? These guys have made millions. William Regal has been a superstar in WCW and WWE many times over, and now doing it again in NXT, passing the torch.
Yep.
Why are they taking time to endorse your book? Not just because you have Oscar on your CD, but because they love this thing that is crazy.
That's it.
They want to look for things that are going to help it and help other people love it. And that's why people are doing this. And you see this in even in Ricky, in your book.
Yeah.
You know,
that's right, Ricky. Yeah.
Kind of crazy, but at the same time, why is he? He's kind of crazy. He's got a certain anger to him, but God, he loves this. This is who he is.
And that's my approach always to the wrestling business, or you know, any wrestlers. This Christmas, I was fortunate enough to go and meet current WWE superstar Sheamus. I mean, he texted me. He said, "I'm sorry that we haven't caught up yet. Would you like to come out for lunch?" Like the inner fan of me, I'm 36 years old. I have my own family. I have my own life. I'm, you know, a supposed man in the world. I giggled like a schoolgirl from my hometown in Wexford for 2 hours on a train, off the train. Because when I got to Dublin and I met Sheamus, who was an absolute gentleman.
And huge. Couldn't do enough. He's huge. A giant.
Yes, he's huge. In the middle of that conversation, Finn Balor, who's you know going to be the biggest wrestler in the world in under five years, he texted me and wanted to meet me in Brea, which is just another hour away, and I giggled for an hour from the meeting with Sheamus to the meeting with Finn Balor, and I'm thinking, why are all these guys going out of their way to come and meet me? And the reason is because one guy said I'm okay. You know, a guy that they respect says he's all right, he's with us, or, you know, he's all right. He's in, if you like. Then the next guy says it, the next guy says it, the next guy says it. And as long as you don't ruin that in some stupid way and be respectful, I'm always humble and respectful to anybody. I'll give you another one. I'll just move off the wrestling thing because it's a writing show.
Sure.
Based on these novels, I sold the TV rights to the first 2 novels, and they went into development. And within a couple of months after that, I was in Hollywood. So again, I was in Ireland, Wanda, and the next day I was in Hollywood going through customs, where you know your fine customs officers were asking me, you know, what's your business here?
And as they do,
and I just find it bizarre to say I'm here to talk about my TV series, you know. Of course, I've been at it. They were like, yeah, move along. Everybody's here for that.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't hand you a headshot. You know, exactly. Like, hey, well, if you need a TCA guy.
And, you know, so it was bizarre to me because I'm fascinated, of course, by the, you know, the Hollywood machine, the TV and the movie business as well. And I met a lot of contacts there. And I just think people get a sense that you're legit. That you're not some asshole and that you're respectful for it. And I think as well, people kind of sniff out whether you're willing to work for this or not, you know, or whether you're one of these guys or girls who just wants to kind of breeze in and kind of get, you know, fame, whatever that is, you know, it takes an awful lot of talent and an awful lot of work for particularly writers to get up the chain. So, you know, I'm willing to be there and do that as well. So, you know, from writing these kind of self-published novels in Ireland, they're going and selling, you know, 70,000 copies in America, to been flown over to Hollywood on the back of them, to sitting in the writer's room and help writing my own pilot, to coming back home now. We've just signed a rollover for year 2 on that developmental deal just a couple of days ago. And now I'm signed to a literary agent. I only done that this weekend as well, who came and sought me out. It's kind of mind-blowing stuff. You don't think of all this stuff happening when you're sitting down and you're writing, you know, like a passion project, if you like.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations, first of all. It's really exciting stuff. And it's...
Thank you.
For people who are listening going, man, I wish I had that. You can have it too. You know what I mean? I don't mean that in an infomercial way. But the thing really? that I like in that you did here, and something that I... let me collect my thought, because I always say this in kind of a crazy way.
Yeah.
Well, something that actors talk about a lot, and I don't think writers talk about it enough. I know that we could find articles and things of writers talking about this, but they don't talk about it enough. And maybe this speaks almost more to some of your playwriting experience, but I always listen to actors say, I try to find the truth in the character, the truth in the character. Yeah. You know what I mean? No matter if an actor is playing a lying psychopath who is a disgusting, horrible human being, they have to put themselves in that horrible psychopaths day to day and their motivations and things. And a writer, I think we as writers don't talk enough about the truth of a situation, the honesty of a situation, and approaching things honest. And I find myself giving that note a lot to other screenwriters and giving myself that note a lot. Like, damn, you're not being honest. You're not being honest. It's not the right way to do it. And I think you've approached this project. You mentioned passion project, but you also talked about the word con.
Yeah.
And telling these guys, like, look, I'm not fooling around here. I'm putting this in there. I'm putting the stuff. I'm putting the attempted murder, possibly, of a promoter is on page 20 or 30.
Yeah.
And I think that is a big part of the ingredient.
It really is. I mean, in my other life, my working life, I'm trained in motivational interviewing and cognitive behavioral therapy, right? So
I'm glad I know that now instead of before the interview started. I'm a lot more nervous.
But I find writers ask me as well, you know, what's your greatest tool? And my greatest tool for any writer is go and take a weekend course in CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. It really is the study of why people do what they do. So I work in a drugs rehabilitation wing. I'm fortunate enough to work there for the last 15 years. I get to manage it. I've seen it from, you know, I started off making the tea and now I get to run the place. I tell you, when you go into a place like that, and you have people who have harmed their own children, I don't even mean on purpose. I just mean that they have been goofing off, you know, and their kids haven't been fed in 2 days, or you know, they fall asleep and the house goes on fire or whatever it is. When you sit across from somebody like that and you look them in the face and you'd say, do you know, John or Mary, or why did you do that? And you see them looking for that answer, looking for it, searching. Then you start to realize that what we as writers, you're right, don't do enough is we don't empathize with our characters. We've already predetermined, because our screenwriting manuals or how to write books have told us that there needs to be an antagonist and protagonist. I throw those two terms out the window. There needs to be a compelling story. And of course, what makes compelling story for me is conflict. And what makes compelling conflict is to have one person on one side of the conflict and one person on the other side of the conflict, and have them both pulling in opposite directions. It's up to the reader to decide who is the protagonist and antagonist of that. For me, that's the way I like to write. So I love to start off with an empathetic view. I like to try and put myself in the shoes of the character. And like you say, no matter the action, you know, I always separate out the bad actions from the good person, or, you know, where possible. I don't believe in evil as a concept. I think that's another thing as well that kind of pulls writers down, that if their character goes so far, well, now they're evil.
Yeah.
I must give them a hook. I must give them, you know, an eye patch and a limp and a machete. And so don't do that. I mean, you know, I as a writer, I try to avoid that stuff. You know, somebody can go out and do a horrible thing, and then they can go and live the rest of their lives and help a million people.
Well, Gene Hackman's character in Unforgiven, he wasn't the bad guy in his mind. He was doing the right thing in his, you know, so many of these guys in bad, John Wayne and Red River, like so many of these guys. You got to see Eddie Coyle, man. You're going to love it.
Yeah.
It's totally right up your alley. You're going to see that Shades of Grey. But I love that about those 70s crime dramas, like French Connection.
Yeah.
I mean, is that...
Absolutely.
You don't want to run... I mean, oh, we're Gene Hackman again. Like, we're going to cheer him on to get the drug dealers, but you don't want to run into that cop in a bar.
No way. No way. Exactly. I mean, And this is what's perfect to me. And unfortunately, you see, we do a lot of things in shorthand now. And you know, our movies have gone that way. Thankfully, TV hasn't, you know. Yeah. So we all know this. I mean, TV is just that beautiful place where writers can go now. I mean, when the producer was looking to buy the rights for Blood Red Turns Dollar Green novels, and they said, well, what do you think? Movies? Miniseries? And I said, TV. Yeah. I said, I've written these like a TV show. I've always wanted these to be a TV show. And you know, I would gladly spend the next 20 years of my life bouncing around from, you know, quality TV show to quality TV show if I could.
Now, when you wrote the novel, I want to talk about some of your choices that you made. These are proper novels, though. It's not like a treatment.
No, these are full proper novels. I spent each novel it took me a year of my life. And again, as a pro writer like you are, it wasn't a year of my life like I wrote on a Wednesday evening, or, you know, I'm talking about Christmas Day and New Year's. It's kind of hard, full on, kind of, you know, proper writing.
And then there's kind of a non-linear element to them as well. Where did that come from?
I'd like to use that in these novels as a device. Again, it was a decision I made early on, in that I use that as a way, in a way, if there is a bad guy in my novels, it's time.
Mm.
Do not trust time in these novels. It's the time is the one that is out. So I'm saying this to all the readers, even if, you know, if some of you go out to pick these novels up, the time plan these is the one that's out to get you, not the characters. You know, so I wanted to unravel, like, so if you think of the first novel, Blood Red Turns Dollar Green, Volume 1, I wrote that like a wrestling angle. And, of course, I couldn't have, you know, seven cameras and I couldn't have all of that. So I used time to symbolize showing the one action from several different angles that paints the characters in a different light, each angle.
Mm.
And because I couldn't set it up like, you know, like a movie or a TV show, I used time to do that. The second book then is more a cops and robbers novel. It is your 70s gritty novel. It's the same characters. You know, it is the effects of the first novel and the second novel. And then as the second novel goes into the third novel, which is 1980s, that's written like a wrestling match.
Right.
So with the big comeback at the end and everything, and, you know, it very much has its heart on its sleeve in that regard. So I wanted to write three novels that's set in the same world, that spans from 69 to 1982, that has three completely different thematic gears to it, but are the one set of novels. So that was the challenge that I set myself as a writer. I didn't just want to write a sequel and just, you know what you do with a sequel, you add a character and you give your hero some other trials and tribulations to get over. I didn't want to do that. You know, there's very finite things happen in these novels that moves this world in completely different directions from novel to novel.
Something I want to throw out at you, just listening to you talk like that, is something that makes me crazy. And I don't want to sound like an asshole as I say this, but I just might. Yeah. Is when I see something on social media or in a group email or LinkedIn group or something like that, where somebody says, looking for my next idea, what should I write about? And it makes me kind of crazy, and I'm not trying to sound snotty or bad with those people or anything, but it's like, this story possessed you.
Yes.
Like, I could just, listening to your answer, like, this story, and that's what has to happen. You have to find that idea that literally possesses you. And I dare say, I could be wrong, I'm sure there's exceptions to every generalization, you're not going to find that by somebody chiming in on Facebook.
No.
You have to find something that is going to absolutely grip and possess you. And it's just listening to you answer it like this, it's like, you know, that's a great reminder for aspiring writers. You know, if you're not completely 100% bought in on the idea, you're not going to buy anybody else in. Because, Paul, I dare say, it sounds like, even though you were reaching out to a lot of wrestlers and getting wrestlers to endorse this, and you got a ton of the wrestling community have been reading these books, these books are probably written for non-wrestling fans.
First and foremost. The volume one, one Spine Tingler's crime novel of the year, number two, one Pull Pusher's crime novel of the year, complete 100% crime fans, nothing to do with wrestling at all. And the reviews coming from that side of the house, the crime side of the house, have been, why hasn't there been more written about this world?
Right.
You know, that this is kind of like the new mafia. And that if you take it, if you put it on paper, we spoke about it earlier, about the territories, the America has been split up, a boss in each territory, a lieutenant under the boss. It's a real secretive world, really hard to get into. You know, the amount of hoops you had to jump through to get into the wrestling business because of the secret, because of the con, really hard to get out of. I mean, who in the 70s and 80s got out of wrestling?
Right.
You know, even now people find it nearly impossible to get out of. It was a cash business with the government looking after for match fixing. You know, so when you lay it out on paper like that, it is very much the mafia template. Except these guys were so good at it that even today, in 2015, very, very, you know, few people around the world know how brilliant these guys were at hoovering up cash with an illicit match fixing and moving from town to town to do it.
And I like the phrase con. I'm not offended by con because it was a con we all wanted to buy into.
Exactly.
No wrestling fan has ever truly fooled, but we all enjoyed it kind of thing. But I also can't help but think when we describe the territories and things like that, like if people are still unclear what that means, think of the baseball owners. Think about like 1950s baseball teams and things like that, like the wars between the Red Sox, like the Dodgers moving to LA. I mean, things like that. That was a lot of the world of the CD territories and things. It was very much part of the cultural zeitgeist at the time.
Really, really was, you know, and this is why I was so surprised when I got there that there was nobody else standing there. So, I mean, you know, again, to kind of talk to your writers or your potential writers out there who are listening, very early on in these novels, after the first novel came out, so I self-published the first novel, an agent from a big New York agency came on and said that I've heard about these novels, I'd like to represent you, I've already read your novel. I said, thank you very much, this is amazing. She said, I've only one note. I thought, well, this is doubly amazing, because you know yourself with people coming on with notes.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I'd like you to take the wrestling out of it. And so I was sitting there for 2 seconds kind of thinking, just typical, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I could take the wrestling out and I could go to the right-hand side and I could be crime writer number 10,000,072.
Yeah.
Or I could leave the wrestling in and go to the left-hand side and be literally the only guy that you can describe as the crime wrestling guy. And so I just said to her, no, thank you very much. I'm going to stick. And, you know, she said, well, you're going to have to prove the concept and it's a whole new world and we're going to have to educate all your readers and blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, that's your world. I'm not here to educate anybody. I'm here to write as best as I can and I'm here to put it out and trying to get it into as many hands as I can. That's my job. You know,
yeah, but the thing that bothers me about the educate people, like my girlfriend doesn't like wrestling. She does not care for wrestling at all. But if I say to her, two guys are having a wrestling match, she knows exactly what's happening.
Exactly.
Like, there's actually a lot more. I mean, it's part of our culture. So I'm not entirely sure. And everything is explained, like the phrases of kayfabe and things like that. And all that stuff is explained. And it's explained in that kind of, you know, one of the best bits of exposition ever done was in Jurassic Park, when it's like, okay, let's all get in a cart, let's show you how the DNA works, and now let's quickly move on to when the dinosaurs are chasing people. Like, that's it. And
that's very good.
Yeah. Doesn't have, but your book kind of does the same thing, where it's not belabored, because the book isn't about really the intricacies of what kayfabe and heel and all of these phrases are. It's about Lenny being torn between his, you know, having to answer to Dano and take care of his family. It's about the struggles of what these people are going through.
You know, when people ask me, so people who've read the three novels, like they'd say to me, you know, I think I love these novels. I think it's about this or it's about that. In my mind, it's kind of like Lenny is Dorothy, who lands in this weird world and he spends three novels just trying to get home. You know, and he's pulled and he's torn and he meets all these characters and, you know, To talk about the wrestling bit again, just for a second.
Please.
Like, I love House of Cards. It's about your political system in your country. It just so happens that I'm a bit of a political junkie myself. But my wife has no interest in American politics. You know, we live in an island 4,000 miles away.
Sure.
She didn't really understand the concept of the Speaker of the House and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But she just is fascinated by this program.
because it's about the power grab, the money grab. It's about you know, what is this couple willing to do to get whatever the brass ring is? And of course, in that program, it just happens to be the White House. And now, as we see with this season comes up, they do have the brass ring. Now, how is it going to kill them?
Exactly.
You know, so, and that, you know, I think if writers can understand that, if writers can find a unique enough concept, you know, so for me, it was the wrestling world. And if they can boil that down then to things that people find, you know, commonality in, and it can be, you know, how can, you mentioned sci-fi earlier, how can readers and watchers of sci-fi get so wrapped up in sci-fi stories when in theory we shouldn't know or feel anything about it?
Right.
It's because it always comes down to the human element of it.
Exactly.
I didn't know why I love Star Wars, but I just knew that I cheered Luke Skywalker on, and I knew when I heard that, dun, 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 that I didn't like Darth Vader when I was a kid. Yeah, so and it built from there, and then it just showed me cool stuff.
Yeah, it's absolutely character. You know, it's funny, Stephen Sky and I talked about this a while ago of like how, you know, Rocky seduced a nation of non-boxing fans.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
You're rooting for Rocky. You're rooting for this goofy guy who's hitting on the shy girl at the pet shop, walking in, telling stupid jokes every night. Because, like, I said this before, but, like, I remember watching it over Christmas time, and I'm like, there's a very little amount of boxing in this movie.
It's all true.
And it's, your novel, there's very little wrestling in this, yes. novel.
And it hangs on the walls, it drips from the ceilings, because, you know, it is the brass ring, like I've said, but there's very little wrestling. We spend maybe 4 minutes, 2 minutes maybe, between the ropes, you know, out of a 75,000 to 80,000 word novel.
Yeah.
And the thing, I mean, to talk about Rocky as well, the thing that I thought Sylvester Stallone done brilliantly, now that I'm an adult and now that I'm a writer, that I hated when I was a kid, was that scene just before the fight scene, which is the I'm having doubt scene.
Yeah.
I need you to lean on her, and I just want to go the distance. And like, as a kid, I was standing up and saying, no, that's not the way stories are written, you know, because I'm used to all the other kind of macho.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get them.
We're going to win at all costs. And if we don't win, then the journey was a failure. And so I thought he was really brave as a writer to write that scene. Where he didn't, you know, say, yeah, well, you know, I finally turned around. I've realized that, you know, winning is the only way to derive satisfaction from life, and I'm going to win at all costs. Yeah. Yeah. It would have been such a disappointment to hear that scene.
And that's why so many other Rocky movies fail. That's why so many of the imitations actually fail. It's about the crime. It's about the character stuff. You know, one of my favorite scenes in the book, and I think it's the christening.
Yeah,
when the Lenny and his wife walk in, and she doesn't want a lot to do with the wrestling business, and they walk in the church, and there's Dan L. Garland, the promoter, and all the wrestlers doing a nice thing, and she's like, "What the fuck are they doing here?" You know,
because
that's
what I love about that is you can only imagine it from her eyes. You know, she's going to have this kind of angelic, very white, you know, christening moment. We're going to touch the Lord and all this sort of stuff. And she walks in, and it's like a biker's club in there. There's not only leather, and there's no teeth between any of them. You know, some of them are 7 foot tall and tattooed. There's bearded women. There's, you know, usually fat wrestling twins. There's, and all the oddities that come with wrestling have now started to pour into her world.
But just to go a step further, because I worry that some people look at scenes like that and say, oh, I'll just put a bunch of zany stuff together. And it's like, no. It's about... It's about Lenny trying to do the right thing for his family and be a responsible father when he's kind of an absentee much of the time. It's about her having the life she wants. And it's about Dano, this rather crooked, but rather still has a bit of a heart of a... He's silver tongue and a heart of gold.
Yes.
Thinking, oh, let me do the right thing. And it's the confluence of those three things that makes the scene work. If you were just to put a bunch of zany wrestlers into, like, if they crash a wedding for no reason, doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. And again, like, I love talking about the writing end of that. I love indirect pressure. You know, the Coen brothers are fantastic at it. And so I was thinking when I was writing that scene, okay, Lenny here is cruising along, and we see him. He's driving the new Cadillac. It's not his now; it's his boss's. But still, he's imagining this could be his car. Mm-hmm. You know, he's sitting at the table. Now, Dano's inviting him in to eat at the nice restaurants. He's traveling the country. Meanwhile, his wife has just had a miscarriage. She finds herself pregnant again. She's living in Lenny's parents' house, like in one bedroom, trying to raise a family. And I was thinking, okay, Lenny, it's time to start putting some pressure on Lenny's character now. But I don't want to put direct pressure on him because it's too obvious and it's too lazy. And so I always like the indirect pressure. So how do I start the ping pong? If I imagine like a handball alley and I lash the ball against the left-hand wall, how do I get it to hit the back wall, but I want it to hit three other walls at the same time? And I love this kind of setup in movies and novels and whatever else the story is coming from. And so with that, if you can imagine the scene, you painted there is a beautiful scene because it starts off as a very happy day. Lenny is home on his day off. His wife is snuggling to his shoulder. This kid is the kid after the miscarriage that they've had. It's almost like this kid is kind of, you know, bonding them back together again. This makes everything whole. And when she walks into the church, she sees this world that has, you know, has kidnapped her husband, now is starting to bleed into her own world. And of course, who starts to feel the pressure? Lenny. Yeah. So Lenny now can't tell his boss to get out. Is trying to appease his wife, is trying to get his kid christened, has to tell her that he needs to get back on the road again, but also has to tell his boss that I can't leave right now. And so, you know, in that scene, I hope that the tension starts to ring around Lenny. And of course, that helps the audience then feel something for Lenny. Now, whatever they feel, of course, is up to the reader. But I want them to feel something for him in that scene.
Yeah, because he's not winning.
No, he's not.
There is no winning scenario for him where it's like, oh, I'm going to get out of this one fine.
Exactly.
And that's almost his lot in many of these scenes of like, yes. Lenny's the poor guy. Anyway, if you're not a wrestling fan, don't worry. Pick up Blood Red, Dollar Green. If you're a fan of these type of crime thrillers, if you're a fan of seedy underbellies and worlds that you didn't know were there and great characters, click on the links below. You'll find the links to Blood Red Turns Dollar Green from Paul O'Brien. Paul, this was just an absolute pleasure to talk about writing with you. This was so fun.
I've had a ball. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the wrestling, and you know, the wrestling business, it gets in your blood. I mean, you were talking about the Oscar thing. It's like the Handsome Timmy D name came from my involvement in wrestling. You know, that was I was going to be a manager and character and everything, and then our very small promotion went out of business, and I got into TV and movies. But I took the name because it stands out.
I had a feeling that the handsome part was something to do, particularly when I read your CV. You know, I had a feeling.
And of course, like all great wrestling ideas, it wasn't mine. It's definitely from other people. So, anyway, so Paul, thanks again. This was fantastic. And then, hey, listen, you got to get that TV show off the ground, and then you're going to come back on, and we'll promote the TV show.
Absolutely.
And we'll rock and roll from there. So, thank you so much. Don't hang up. We'll do some business afterwards. And thank you, dear reader, dear listener, for reading, downloading, listening, spreading the word on social media. We appreciate it. Lots more to come this year on the Handsome Timmy D Express.